A COVID whistleblower goes to jail. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Rebecca Jones made news last year when she was fired from her job running the state's COVID-19 dashboard. Last month, authorities raided her house. She was arrested over the weekend. We'll get the latest. Also,
a toothless guy who's poaching orchids in South Florida. It doesn't instantly grab you as a great story.
More than 20 years ago, Susan Orlean brought us into the world of orchid obsession with her book, The Orchid Thief. Today, we discuss how that story became a book. And finally, former inaugural poet Richard Blanco shares his thoughts on the poet chosen for this year's inauguration. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. A former Florida Department of Health employee who became a whistleblower during the coronavirus pandemic has been arrested and charged with a third-degree felony. Rebecca Jones turned herself into authorities over the weekend. Jones was one of the architects of the state's COVID-19 dashboard. She was fired from her position for insubordination, but started her own community COVID-19 site that was crowdfunded. Back in December, her home was raided by law enforcement and her data was confiscated. Jones tweeted yesterday that she recently tested positive for COVID-19 herself. Lawrence Mowers, a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald, based in the Tallahassee Bureau. And he joins us now. Lawrence, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
So let's start with this. Jones started, she turned herself in to the Leon County Jail in Tallahassee. What are the charges that she's facing?
Well, she's facing a single charge of accessing a computer system while knowing she's not allowed to access it. You know, basically, the state is saying that she, after she had left the department, this would have been back in November, she logged into a Department of Health messaging system and basically urged people to speak out about manipulated data and wrongdoing within the Department of Health. And so she's facing basically a single third degree felony for doing that, which is the lowest form of felony and has about a sentence of up to 5 years in prison.
So we know that the authorities conducted a raid on her home last month. How is the raid connected to the charges she's facing now?
Well, the evidence that the state says they have comes from that raid. FDLE, the state police, said that when they seized her computer during the raid, they found cookies, basically bits of information on her computer that they say showed she had logged into this system multiple times in November and had even downloaded an Excel spreadsheet from it. Basically, it was a spreadsheet of about 19,000 people's contact information. It doesn't appear to be confidential information, but they're saying that this is data that it belongs to the Department of Health. And they say they found that on her computer, that she had downloaded that.
For those people who are unfamiliar with her story, just briefly, what was her responsibility at the Florida Department of Health?
Well, she was the Department of Health's geographic information systems manager. That's kind of a behind the scenes role, but she was one of the stars of the department, at least initially at the beginning of the outbreak. When she was there, she created this COVID-19 dashboard, basically showing cases, COVID-19 cases around the state by county. It was incredibly detailed. It was available for the public to see where COVID cases were happening. This was at the beginning of the pandemic. She was heralded and for creating this system kind of on her own. And, you know, DeSantis himself touted it, saying, hey, look how transparent we're being. We got this great thing up there. Dr. Deborah Birx, who is the White House's coronavirus response coordinator, said on national TV, said this dashboard that Florida created is amazing. Other people should have it. It was really a model for other states.
And then
that was really her name to fame.
She was let go. Why?
Well, that's in some dispute. She said that she was reassigned and then fired because she refused to manipulate some of the COVID data on that dashboard. Governor's office said that was wrong, that was false, that she was fired for basically, as they said it, repeated insubordination. But since then, she's been, you know, one of the most outspoken critics of the governor, Governor Ron DeSantis. And, you know, she's been on national TV talking about DeSantis and allegations about manipulating the data. And she's gotten hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers since then.
Now, we spoke with Jones over the summer shortly after she started the community dashboard to challenge the state's dashboard. She raised a number of concerns about the reliability of the data that was presented by the state. Here's what she said.
When it came to changing the numbers, I knew that the dashboard was the face of this response and that it had bipartisan support and it was trusted. It was actually held up as the gold standard of data transparency by FEMA and the software developer, and all over the country this was being shared as pretty much the best that you can do. People trusted it, and I knew if I started deliberately putting in wrong numbers, it would be tantamount to me using this trusted tool to lie to people and say it was safe to start resuming normal activity when it wasn't.
She accused the state basically of misinformation. How did the state respond to that, Lawrence?
Well, they've denied it, but the Department of Health has really done a poor job explaining changes to the data. You know, various news outlets have seen, changes to the data, cases disappear from the data with no explanation. You know, the Sun Sentinel had a story last month about a mysterious drop in COVID deaths leading up to the election in November, you know, indicating that it might've been manipulated. And the Department of Health didn't even respond to them. And this has been basically a repeated problem with them. They rarely explain these things. And so, you know, we're kind of left to wonder.
You know, for you as a journalist, I'm wondering, you know, your level of skepticism towards the state's data, but also Jones's data.
Well, I personally have not gone through Jones's data, and we have other reporters who are assigned full time to like looking at the state's data. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are skeptical, and it's not hard to be skeptical considering how many questions everyone has had about this, and not just about the data. You know, the DeSantis administration has been extremely secretive about its coronavirus response. It rarely explains its actions. And because a lot of DeSantis's actions appear to be things that help or at least align with President Donald Trump, a lot of people had this inherent skepticism. And frankly, he's not done a good job assuaging people of that skepticism.
Again, I'm talking with Lawrence Maurer, reporter with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times in the Tallahassee Bureau, talking about Rebecca Jones, a former Florida Department of Health employee charged with overseeing the state's COVID-19 dashboard. She was arrested, facing felony charges. You can find more information and more of Lawrence's reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I mean, going off what you just said, Lawrence, I mean, does this arrest just seem to have a little bit of political motivation for the DeSantis administration? I mean, they've been butting heads since the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rebecca Jones obviously is one of the most prominent critics of the governor, but it's ultimately hard to say whether or not this is a politically motivated investigation. But, you know, you got to note that it's hard to ignore that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which did this investigation, reports to DeSantis. And, you know, FDLE has not been immune from politics. If you recall, the previous head of FDLE, Jerry Bailey, said he was subject to political interference under the Rick Scott administration, and there have been other issues since then. So, you know, on the other hand, the state says that she went into this system multiple times, and they say they have evidence of that. So it's kind of hard to say.
That community dashboard that she was running, I mean, who's running it now, or what's happening with it?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know. You know, I know some of the money that she collected to help fund that dashboard is probably going to her defense.
Yeah.
She said that it was going to go towards that, some of it at least.
You mentioned a little while ago too, is what the Department of Health was doing just into the run-up to the election, you know, again, kind of downplaying the severity of the virus. But what have we seen in the past couple of months now that cases are surging again?
I have not seen any real changes to that data, but you know, most of the attention right now has been focused on the vaccine rollout. for the last couple months. And, you know, and on that, it's kind of a continuation of the same issues. The vaccine rollout has been very confusing. Changes are made with no explanation. The DeSantis administration still hasn't told us basic stuff like where these vaccines have been distributed. And these are just the same kind of recurring questions about lack of transparency and you know, wondering about, hey, is politics basically motivating a lot of these decisions? And so, you know, we haven't seen anything change really over the last year.
What's next for Jones after she posts bail? I mean, what's the expected trial?
It's a little too early to say about an expected trial. You know, she's posted bail and she's been released, and she just tweeted a few minutes ago about how she's recovering from COVID. It's not really clear when the next hearing will be. But, you know, if this were a normal case, basically if this was a case against someone who is much less prominent than Rebecca Jones, you know, a third degree felony would probably be pleaded down to a misdemeanor, because this is the lowest level of felony case. But, you know, this is not a normal case. This is an extremely prominent person now in Florida and a DeSantis critic. And it's really hard to say what will happen with this case.
Far from a normal case, a story we have talked about plenty of times, both of us on this program.
Certainly have.
Lawrence Maurer, reporter with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times, and the Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lewis.
And again, you can follow his stories on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, how a small article about an orchid thief led to a best-selling book and movie adaptation. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. In the mid-90s, there was a small story in the Miami Herald about a man who was being tried for poaching orchids in the Everglades. That story inspired author Susan Orlean to write a piece in The New Yorker, and it inspired her later to write a book called The Orchid Thief. And that book eventually turned into the Oscar-winning film adaptation starring Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep. Now, The Orchid Thief is the Sundial Book Club title for January. We spoke with Susan recently and started by asking her to take us back to the day when she saw that original Miami Herald article.
I remember it vividly. I was flying back through Miami. I began just looking to see if there was anything to read in the seat pocket. As it turned out, someone had left a copy of the Miami Herald. My eye fell immediately on a headline that said something to the effect of a local nurseryman arrested with rare orchids. And I thought, oh, that sounds like an interesting story. I started reading it, and it was really a baffling little news story about the arrest of John LaRoche. And none of it made sense to me. I couldn't understand why someone would be arrested for having orchids. That, I think, was my first question. And my second question is, why would someone steal orchids? I mean, orchids are pretty easy to get. And I couldn't imagine why you would steal orchids rather than just going to Home Depot and buying them.
When did it become a book, or when did you decide there's more here?
As I was working on the story, I was constantly aware of how many more directions the story seemed to point to. Even though New Yorker stories are quite substantial and pretty long for a magazine story, I just felt like there was so much more to say. As I came to the end of writing the New Yorker piece, I called my agent and I said, I know this sounds crazy, but I want to do a book about this. I knew that my publisher would be a little puzzled. If, you know, it's not that easy to come in and say, I want to do a book about a toothless guy who's poaching orchids in South Florida. It doesn't instantly grab you as a great story. But I was really passionate about it, and I felt certain that there was a great book in the story.
You have a beautiful way of describing orchids and people. And I wanted you to tell me, elaborate a little bit more about that first day you met John LaRoche.
I was very struck by him. He makes a real impression. And I knew almost from the very beginning that I was going to start the story by describing him. Among other things, he had come to court wearing a sort of dirty t-shirt and jeans, and yet stood up in court and announced that he was the smartest person essentially in the world. So I thought this guy has a kind of arrogance and ego that's just fascinating. And he cuts a interesting figure. I mean, he's very tall and very skinny. He had all of his front teeth knocked out in a car accident, and he hadn't bothered to replace them, which to me was also very telling. I mean, he's just a person who marches to his own drummer. Mm. And something that might make other people feel self-conscious, like not having front teeth, it just didn't faze him. Nothing seemed to kind of get in his way of being who he was. It occurred to me that I really wanted to describe the impact that it had on me seeing him for the first time.
So, Susan, this is a great scene in the book where you and John are going to basically an orchid show, right, in Fort Lauderdale, and you're about to buy tickets, or he thinks you've got a pass to get in for free, right?
Right. I think he just assumed that as a journalist, I should be able to get a hold of these tickets for us. So I'll begin sort of in the middle of that scene. The tickets were $6. LaRoche looked at me. "Can't you get these for free?" he asked. "Free? How would I get them for free?" I said. LaRoche frowned and then stepped in front of me and said to the man at the ticket table, "Hey, how about if you give us two tickets?" The ticket seller chuckled and stuck out his hand, palm up. "It's research," LaRoche insisted. The man's hand didn't move. The door to the auditorium opened and a couple came through, leaving the show. The man was balancing a box full of plants on his hip. As they walked by, he was saying, "I am really not a Cattleya person, Dee Dee." And she was shaking her head and saying, "Well, I am really not a PAF person, Phil." A rush of warm air picked up one of the show programs sitting on the table, and it went fluttering and landed with a sigh on the floor. A fidgety line was forming behind us. I counted out $12 into the ticket man's hand. LaRoche dropped the stubs in the prize drawing box.
Considering the you know, that arrogance, considering his personality, how did he take to you?
This is the great thing about writing about a person who's pretty egocentric. They love attention. And he loved the idea that he was teaching me about orchids. And actually, that was a lot of our relationship. I didn't know anything about orchids. He believed that he knew everything about orchids, and he did know a great deal about them. So our relationship initially had that dynamic, which was I was the naive, fumbling, bumbling New Yorker, and he was the smart expert on Florida, on orchids, and he was willing to teach me. And I think it really appealed to his ego. And also, you know, he really does have this interesting desire to impart his knowledge.
Did you trust him, though, or did you have to go and double check everything he kept telling you?
I was skeptical. I didn't think he was a liar, but I didn't some of his stories were so fantastical that I didn't quite believe them. And many of them seemed a little more dramatic than was entirely credible. So I did have to do a lot of double checking. And then some of the stories, I felt like what was interesting was his version of the story, not whether it was true or not true, but that he construed it in such a way that told you a lot about him. Yeah. He tended to see his life in these very big, dramatic, sweeping narratives. And were the narratives actually true or not? In many instances, it was too hard to actually fact check them because they were personal incidents. But he's a storyteller. He likes crafting these dramas, and I felt like that was essential to the story, was seeing him in that light.
We're talking with author Susan Orlean. Her book, The Orchid Thief, is the Sundial Book Club January title. You can learn more about the book and other choices that we have for our book club on our Facebook page. Just look up Sundial Book Club. The book was eventually made into a movie called Adaptation, starring Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep. We got some fascinating responses from readers on the Facebook page. And one of them is Craig Pittman. He's an environmental journalist in the west coast of Florida. He wrote a piece after your book came out about some of the concerns that some orchid enthusiasts had with the credibility of your research. But we're in no position to fact check his claims about how many hybrid orchids exist in the Everglades. But I am curious to hear this. You were with a lot of these folks, hardcore, diehard orchid collectors who know this world. How did you deal with any of the criticism that's coming from these folks after your book came out? You know, what were they telling you? You know, because I'd imagine some people were probably willing to jump on you and say, wait a second, what does she know about orchids?
Right. Well, that's always the challenge when you're a journalist. I don't pretend to be an expert on anything I write about. I'm an expert in learning. I'm very good at learning. And I write about things that I don't know anything about. And part of my challenge and my expertise is figuring out how to learn about a new subject and a subculture. I knew, given the kind of clannishness of the orchid world, that there would be people who didn't feel I had any right to write about orchids because I wasn't part of their world, which is, of course, totally absurd. Or they would nitpick over tiny facts that they felt that I got wrong or I didn't represent properly. You know, for every fact in the book was fact-checked. It doesn't mean there aren't occasionally errors that sneak through, of course, but you've got several layers of fact-checking and copy editing to try to make sure that the facts as they are presented are accurate. Quotes, for instance, if John LaRoche asserts something, that's not a fact that I'm presenting to you what he is asserting, and I want to leave it as it is because it's more about illustrating his sense of himself as opposed to that it is in itself accurate. This is the thing. You don't want a book about an insular world necessarily written by someone who is in that insular world. That's what I bring to it, is the perspective of an outsider who's coming into this world and learning about it, and it has a certain amount of objectivity to look at it and construct it. And every book I've ever written has introduced me to a new world that I knew nothing about. And I think I've done a pretty good job of making my way in these subcultures and creating books that stand up to scrutiny.
One of the things I loved about the book myself is, again, how you describe some of the places that you got to go to. And of course, you know, where, you know, John found himself getting in trouble and where a lot of people were going to try to find orchids was this little place, this little area of Southwest Florida called the Fakahatchee Strand. And I just wanted to get your first impression when you first arrived there.
I had spent a lot of time in Florida, both just on family vacations, and then I had written a number of stories over the years about Florida. It's a really interesting place, and it seems like there's always a story waiting to be told in South Florida. So I was not a stranger, but what I found so interesting is that in spite of all the time I had spent in Florida, I never even heard of the Fakahatchee. I had never been in that part of Florida. I had no idea that that kind of wilderness existed so near the very, very much domesticated parts of Florida that I was more familiar with. So that was a lot of what fascinated me. I mean, my parents had a condo in West Palm Beach, so I was really just a hop, skip, and a jump away from the Fakahatchee, but I had no idea it existed. Driving from my parents', you know, gated condo community to the Fakahatchee and seeing it for the first time was a bit of a revelation, that feeling of, this is what Florida, had it not been settled, might have looked like. Yeah. It was a real revelation to see what Florida on its own would have looked like. And of course, part of the thing that became so interesting was learning that the Fakahatchee actually wasn't virgin wilderness at all, and it had been planned as a huge subdivision that simply never developed, and then it kind of returned to being wild. So that was even more interesting than being in virgin wilderness. This was reclaimed wilderness. I had never been in a real swamp before. So when I first got to the edge of the Fakahatchee and was told to step in, I was not thrilled. I was really reluctant and thought, I can't believe I'm doing this. I do not want to go in there. And I really, really fought every instinct to keep myself out. You know, I looked at it as just teeming with rattlesnakes and alligators and spiders and God knows what else. And I was really nervous. And it took every ounce of my journalistic fortitude to convince myself to go in. And then as it turned out, I went in several times because I really needed to for the sake of the book. And each time it was challenging though. I think there is a natural instinct that we humans have, which is to look at a swamp and resist.
That's a good point. I've lived in Florida most of my life and I still feel that way. That's a really good point. I wanted to ask you about the movie adaptation, which was called Adaptation, starring Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep. Charlie Kaufman, the director, and he's known for taking very creative approaches with his films. The way he approached this, I mean, Nicolas Cage is more or less a representation of Kaufman, and he's struggling with the adaptation of the book in the script. Did you appreciate the layers of complexity of that approach, or did it stray way too much from your story because it was getting all meta?
I love the movie. I think that it gets at the themes of the book in a much deeper way than a straightforward adaptation would have or could have. It really did look at this central theme, which is what is the role that passion plays in our lives, and what's the struggle between art and commerce. And really, it was, to me, as in many ways, a more faithful adaptation than just a literal adaptation of the book would have been.
You know, one of the other things too, in the book, you hint at wanting to be careful not to fall into the obsession like all the other characters that you introduce us to. But I wonder, after finishing the book, did you understand what that obsession was? Why do they have it?
Absolutely. It is, I think for me, this was a journey into understanding the function that a passion for anything fills in our lives. Orchids happen to be fascinating. I mean, they really are genuinely fascinating. They could provide you with an almost unlimited source of curiosity and learning. And, you know, they're so diverse and strange and marvelous looking. So just as a thing that is interesting, I understood it much more than I did before I began the book. But in addition, I became very aware of the value of feeling passionate about something, about anything. And whether it's orchids or collecting china or raising dogs or whatever it is, or for many people, it's a passion for their family or religion or politics. The function is what really is important, and it's a way of feeling your place in the world and understanding how to navigate the universe. So I absolutely understood it. And I even came to really appreciate how beautiful orchids are, which was something that I didn't expect to have happen.
That was author Susan Orlean. Her book, The Orchid Thief, is the January title for the Sundial Book Club. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. We're going to have a panel conversation next week with some of our readers about the book, so message us there if you're interested in joining. Susan's most recent book, The Library Book, is also available in local bookstores. Well, still to come, with tomorrow's historic presidential inauguration, we introduce you to President Obama's inaugural poet, Richard Blanco. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. More people have been to the moon than have served as a presidential inaugural poet. We're speaking with one of those five poets today. Richard Blanco was President Obama's inaugural poet in 2013.
Here, the doors we open each day for each other, saying, hello, shalom, buongiorno, howdy, namaste, or buenos dias, in the language my mother taught me, in every language, spoken into one wind, carrying our lives without prejudice.
Tomorrow, that honor belongs to 22-year-old Amanda Gorman. She will be the youngest inaugural poet in U.S. history. Richard is the first Latino, immigrant, and openly gay person to continue the tradition that includes iconic poets like Robert Frost and Maya Angelou. He joins us now. Richard, it is always a pleasure to have you on.
Pleasure to be with us.
You know, I'm thinking about, we're nearing President-elect Biden's inauguration, and after the tumultuous year that we've had. First of all, how are you feeling?
Well, I think like most of us, feeling kind of a little bittersweet. The idea that yes, there's a change. There's change on the horizon, but also thinking about all the work that we still need to do as a country to see what's happened and to rebuild a lot of trust in our democracy. So I'm, like I said, bittersweet in that way.
Yeah. I'm wondering, how do you deal when you think about it? I mean, think about everything that's happened over the past year. And as you said, we're, it's a new chapter. We're flipping the page here. How are you as a poet? I'm wondering, how do you think about those emotions? You know, do you get inspired to just want to write, or are you just sitting with those emotions?
I tend to sit with emotions for a while. I tend to be a writer that writes out of sort of memory, that likes to ferment things for a while, so the poems don't show up right away. On the other hand, there are poems, and I don't want to speak just for me or just for all poets, but I think poets also kind of see into the future at the same time. They have a feeling, and they also project things forward, both personal and public or political, and in some senses, what's happened in the last 4 years, as I've reflected upon, I realize I go back through my last book, How to Love a Country, and realize that a lot of this was already sort of in my mind already. So it's interesting. Poets also, I think, when things are going good, they always look at what's not working. When things are really bad, they're always looking at looking toward hope or some kind of answer to be had.
I was thinking about, because you say hope, and I'm thinking about the poem you read at Obama's 2013 inauguration. It's titled One Today. And you talk about unity and resilience and hope. And I'm wondering, what's giving you hope these days?
The same thing that's giving me despair, ironically, the idea that despite these tumultuous times, that there's a kind of reckoning happening in the United States, and we're dealing with things that we have kept on sweeping under the rug, and so I'm in that same way. I'm hopeful that we may actually move to a different place, and we're talking about racism, talking about, hashtag Me Too. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about all these slew of issues that we've kind of just kept on sort of kicking the can, so to speak. And so I'm hopeful that we will finally start having a different kind of dialogue in America, a very necessary one. Ironically, it's both hope and despair at the same time. I like to say, we throw these words around very easily, like hope, healing, and whatnot. And I think, I've been thinking lately, I'm not even sure we know what we need to heal from, to be honest with you. It's kind of like we need a diagnosis first. We need to have another kind of conversation, because we keep on throwing these words around or unity, as if, easier said than done, right? But I'm not sure that we've really taken a good look at ourselves and really had a reckoning and a dialogue that needs to be had yet in America.
Well, see, one of the things I was thinking about is a great speech or poem can uplift, can, kind of set people into a certain, a certain track of emotion. And you think about some of the great speeches and poems of history. And I'm wondering the role of the inaugural poet and what you thought your role was in 2013 and what you think Amanda Gorman's role is now.
Sure. Something I obviously had to think about 8 years ago. But as I understand it, historically, the inaugural poet it reads towards the end of the ceremony, and it's supposed to provide a kind of vision, a kind of, based on the ideals or echo or reflect what the new presidency might mean. But it's also not a political speech, and it's also not a Hallmark speech either. It's not a Hallmark card speech. It's the idea of like, here's who we have been, here's where we are, and here's where we could be. And what I tried to do is sort of think about, my poem speaks a lot about unity, but it also has a little bit of tension in there, because it's not quite that we're one today. This is who we should be, yeah. as our motto says, out of the many one. But it ends on this idea that we still have work to do, right? That we still need to recognize that. With Amanda, I'm so excited by the choice, Biden's choice for Amanda, because I've been thinking, you know, what is our youth thinking about in these last 4 years? You know, what can we give them? How can we make them understand that we need them? We need their voices. We need them to participate. We need them, that they have agency and power. And so she is a perfect example of that. Someone who is only 22 and knocked me off the youngest inaugural by a whole half. But it's a reflection of also, I think, her and myself and you know, Elizabeth Alexander, et cetera. What I love about that tradition of the inaugural poem is that it's kind of a snapshot of who we are as a country, who we're thinking, what we're shaping up to be as a country. So if you think about Robert Frost from 1968, to me, you know, a gay Latino immigrant working class kid, to now Amanda being this 22, I mean, amazing, right? It sort of says something about what we're thinking about as a country.
Have you spoken with her?
She reached out to me on an Instagram post, and so yes, I did have a chance to connect with her. It was beautiful. It was beautiful to be able to do that. And again, like you said, there's more people have been to the moon than been inaugural poets. So I know she has no one to talk to either, right?
Yeah.
Or very few people. And so I just wanted to offer just my congratulations, and just let her know some of the things she could expect.
Do you have a sense of what she's going to be doing tomorrow?
I don't know. I don't know those details, but I think she's released the title of the poem, which is something up how to climb that hill. I forget at the moment, but I would imagine, God, if I had a hard time, I would imagine she's got a lot to speak to, perhaps so much so, but I'm sure she can pull it off. She's an amazing poet, very seasoned poet, and I think she's just going to be amazing.
If it was you, I mean, again, because it, you know, when you were doing it in 2013, it's such a different world. You know, if it was you today, what do you think you'd want to, you know, the theme? What would you want your poem to be about?
Well, it's interesting because, again, the poem that I did read was a little more hopeful. So again, it still had a little bit of tension. It still had a charge, so to speak. You know, we need to be one today. We need to act on this. We need to act on our motto of out of the many one. But what I would write today would probably be a little more grittier. And by that, I mean a little more aggressive, perhaps a little more direct. And in fact, the White House asked me to write three poems, not just one. And the first one I wrote was a little grittier even back then. And I was looking back at that poem going, you know what, this is the poem I would read now. Because the last line of that poem says, it's speaking to America, and it says, listen, we need to talk. And the whole poem is kind of an analogy of how one's relationship with one's country is kind of like a marriage. It goes through all its phases, and you know, we're at a critical phase now in that you know,
do you
marriage,
Richard, by any chance, do you have that poem? Do you know it?
I do. Let me see if my,
I'll tell you what, look for it. I just, you know, because I'd love to hear it again. While he's doing that, I just want to remind everybody, we're talking with Richard Blanco. He was President Obama's inaugural poet in 2013, the first Latino and immigrant to do so, and continuing the tradition that includes poets. There he is. He's got, okay, the other poets include Robert Frost, Maya Angelou. And as we mentioned, the poet for tomorrow is going to be the youngest, now beating out Richard, is going to be the youngest, Amanda Gorman. The title of her poem is going to be The Hill We Climb, so something to look forward to. So Richard, you do have that poem?
Yeah, her name's on the page.
Okay.
Right.
All right. I mean, and you know, I'm not sure how long it is. We got, we still got like 4 or 5 minutes. You want to read some of it or all of it? If it's not too long, I'd love to hear it.
It's a longish poem because being okay. Cuban, brevity is not the soul of my
okay, so but, let's read a little I'll part of read, it.
I'll just read you that last stanza. And again, okay. The whole idea is this analogy of comparing one's relationship with one's country to a kind of marriage.
And again, this was, you had to write three poems, but this was not the one that the White House had chosen.
Right, this is the first one. It's called What I Know of Country, and here's the last little bit of it. Feeling what we've always felt, to know a country takes all we know of love. Some days better than others, but never easy to keep our promise every morning of every year of every century and wake up, stumble downstairs with all our raging hope, sit down at the kitchen table again, still blurry-eyed, still tired, and say, listen, we need to talk. So a little bit more a little more heavy-handed than but I think we talk about the last 4 years, but I think again there's a reckoning that's been coming a while, and even during Obama's presidency we knew that there's still things still seething that we weren't dealing with.
Yeah, and it's just listening to it, thinking about it, as much as the world has changed, you're right, there was so much that was there, and I think finally just came through, and listening to you there, I'm just like, wow, it would be perfect tomorrow. It would be the thing to hear, that, you know, we all have to sit down and talk to each other. I wondered, do you think that poetry reaches people today? Kind of the way, I mean, because we live in this world of, like, you know, just we're looking at our smartphones all the time, and we're used to either pictures or short videos that catch our attention. Do you think poetry still has that power?
I think very much. In fact, in my lifetime, or since I've been writing, rather, I've seen an incredible rise in say popularity, but in access to poetry, right? Because now it's not just a poem, it's also a video of a spoken word artist. And so it's occupied a lot more public space, in my opinion, and also what I've sort of witnessed, in the same way that song does, right? Like, mm-hmm. We can, you know, watch a video, but now, you know, there's so many ways to access poetry now. And so I do think it's out there. It's definitely something that adds to the conversation, I would say, much more than, you know, say 10, 15 years ago.
And you teach, but I wonder, like, you know, think about that younger generation, like Amanda's generation, and, you know, the role that they're going to play moving forward. But what would you say to them about, you know, using poetry to express those feelings, those fears, but also your hopes? How would they use poetry to let their voices be heard?
Well, I think the first, you know, poetry is also a way of figuring out what one thinks or what one feels, and what questioning one's assumptions, thinking through ideas, and thinking through emotions, processing that, so that when you have something that you come to the page with, the art of poetry makes us sort of parcel that out in a way that is sometimes very surprising. So that's one thing personally. And then how to share that. At some point, the poem becomes something somebody else's, right? It becomes the reader's. It becomes for public engagement, and becomes for public consumption. And I guess the parallel is kind of like song, and you put it out there. And it hopefully will speak to people. We don't always, the thing is with, you know, unlike a rock star or like, you know, a pop star, we don't always see the ripples of what poetry does for people or the arts in general, right? We never kind of get that. We never get that feedback. But yeah. If you ask most people, they will always have a poem in their heart that changed their life. Even if they're not poetry readers, even if they're not, you know, haven't read a poem in 20 years, there's always something that has stayed with them at some point in their life with a poem that speaks to them. So yeah. You have to trust that that's also part of what one does as a poet, that you don't always, it's kind of like teaching in a way too. You don't always get that feedback of what's going on in people's minds or how their lives are changed.
As I said, there are very few inaugural poets, so they are unique. That it's a special breed, and Richard Blanco is always, of course, he is a special breed, and we love having him on all the time. Richard, thank you so, so much. Hope you enjoy tomorrow's, inauguration, and Amanda, we're all rooting for her to just kill it.
Thanks. Great to be with you, and I'm rooting for her too. Can't wait to see that.
Definitely. Again, Richard Blanco, he served as President Obama's inaugural poet in 2013. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, January 19th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to bring you special coverage of President-elect Joe Biden's historic inauguration. Our coverage will begin at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning and will continue throughout the day. You can also find breaking news updates always on our website, WLRN.com. Coming up on Thursday, we're going to introduce you to the new president of Miami-Dade College, Madeline Bumariega. She has a difficult task ahead as the enrollment has declined and they are facing some financial challenges. Plus, we're going to look at the world of competitive high school sports in the midst of the pandemic. Are students still getting actively recruited to college? And what about those scholarships? We'll find out more of that coming up on Thursday. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you live on Thursday.